But bear in mind the information from the last of the Houston Post articles there, the February 18th article of 1990, and the link between Ray Corona, the link between Tony Fernandez and Ray Corona, and the link between Tony Fernandez and Frank Castro. And the Sunshine State Bank, again, a director of it, was the recipient of a loan which helped bring down People's Savings and Loan. The bank, per se, was the recipient of an even larger loan from People's Savings and Loan, although I was in error in stating initially that there was that loan that had brought down the People's Savings and Loan. We're going to read now from an excellent unpublished manuscript that has been put out by Peter, well, has been put together by Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley and one of this country's foremost political researchers. He has put together an excellent manuscript entitled The Contra Drug Connection, and it's subtitled The Contra Drug Connection, How North Used Powers from Bush to Prevent Its Disclosure. And in here there's some very important information setting forth documented connections between the Kerry subcommittee's investigation, as badly compromised as it was, of the connections between the U.S. government and drug smuggling, and the Christic Institute's lawsuit. And the main names here are Frank Chanez, Paco Chanez, or Frank Castro, rather, Frank Chanez, or Paco Chanez, a fellow named Moises Nunez, M-O-I-S-E-S-N-U-N-E-Z, and also a fellow named Rene Corvo. Now, all of these people admit to being involved in training the Contras. Documents obtained from the FBI by the Kerry subcommittee, although not documents figuring prominently in their final report, definitively link some of these same people to drug smuggling on behalf of Contras. And in turn, these same people figure prominently in the Christic Institute's lawsuit, and some of the documents, some of the FBI documents obtained by the Kerry subcommittee tend to confirm many critical aspects of the Christic Institute's suit. This is important to note because it's become something of a cottage industry among certain so-called, certain segments of the so-called progressive political community to dump on the Christic Institute. I'm not pretending that everything they've said is gospel. I don't think very many things that anybody's, I don't think anybody has 100% credibility. And certainly there are many aspects of the Sheehan affidavit and the Christic Institute's case that I have questions about myself. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I'm also not saying that absolutely everything that the Christic Institute says is absolutely valid. The fact of the matter is, though, that not only the Kerry subcommittee, a badly compromised investigation, but now two different investigations by the Costa Rican government, one into drug smuggling and one into the Lapenca bombing, have confirmed in a big way many of the critical aspects of the Christic Institute's suit. The investigation being pursued by, tragically, only the Napa Sentinel and so far yours truly, has also tended to confirm critical aspects of the Christic Institute's allegations. And one of the important aspects of Peter Dale Scott's manuscript here is it points out how FBI documents confirm many of the key connections that were illustrated by the Kerry subcommittee concerning Messrs. Chanez, Castro, and so forth, and their connections to drug smuggling, and that in turn many of the FBI documents obtained by the Kerry subcommittee, many of these documents confirm aspects of the Christic Institute's suit. This is set forth by Peter Dale Scott in an aspect or in a section of his manuscript entitled The FBI's Hard Evidence of Protected Smuggling for the Contras. And again, the title of this unpublished manuscript, The Contra Drug Connection, How North Used Powers from Bush to Prevent Its Disclosure. By the way, this is not available. I obtained this through channels, so I think you might as well not even attempt to look for this until Peter Dale Scott has it in final form. But this is not generally available. However, it's excellent, and because of the information, of the relevance of the information, I'm going to excerpt sections of it for you here on tape. Again, The Contra Drug Connection, How North Used Powers from Bush to Prevent Its Disclosure, this section, the FBI's Hard Evidence of Protected Smuggling for the Contras. Now, remember the names Frank Castro, his associate Frank Chanez, both admittedly trained the Contras, both implicated in drug smuggling. Frank Castro figures prominently in the drug smuggling activities of Tony Fernandez. Tony Fernandez's drug smuggling activities used to start, basically, the Sunshine State Bank. Sunshine State and its directors, in Ray Corona, the founder of the bank, in turn, intimately linked with the failure of People's Savings and Loan in Llano, Texas. That, according to the Houston Post of 218. Proceeding here with Peter Dale Scott's article, or this section of Peter Dale Scott's manuscript. The 1989 report of Senator John Kerry's subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations confirms more clearly than any official U.S. document before it the extent to which U.S. covert operations have been conducted in conscious alliance with major drug traffickers. In Senator Kerry's carefully understated words, the Reagan, quote, Contra policy contributed to helping narcotics traffickers move illegal drugs into this country, unquote. In fact, the documents released by the Kerry Committee reveal a much more alarming picture. It is not simply, as the senator writes, that, quote, the U.S. government has all too often turned a blind eye to narco-trafficking on the part of perceived allies in the name of national security, unquote. These drug alliances are historically deep-rooted and central to our covert policies, not merely byproducts of them. There have even been times when the policies seem to have been designed to preserve and promote the alliances, rather than the alliances to preserve and promote the covert policies. The so-called Southern Front of Contra supporters is an example of this. Never much of a factor in war against Nicaragua, it provided a screen whereby convicted drug traffickers, some of them engaged by a State Department agency, could fly plane loads of cocaine into the United States. This, in turn, helped strengthen and enrich the whole network of drug-related CIA assets, such as Colonel Noriega in Panama, which the U.S. relies on to shore up the status quo in parts of Latin America. FBI documents appended to the Kerry report confirm that the Contra support apparatus in Costa Rica was involved in a number of conspiratorial illegalities as originally alleged in 1986 and denied at that time by government representatives. For example, a Cuban-American, René Corvo, C-O-R-V-O, admitted to the FBI that on March 6, 1985, he had smuggled arms out of the United States in a plane flying to the ranch of John Hull in Costa Rica. These arms, he told them, included a 20-millimeter cannon, a 60-millimeter mortar launcher, and, among other weapons, a .308 caliber sniper rifle from Tom Posey, leader of the American Contra Support Group, CMA. Yet CIA representatives assured members of Kerry's staff in a secret meeting of May 6, 1986, quote, that no weapons were aboard the March 6, 1985 flight. According to information in another FBI report, another Cuban-American associate of John Hull, Francisco Chanes, C-H-A-N-E-S, was giving money from narcotics transactions, quote-unquote, to the, quote, Nicaraguan guerrillas, again, quote-unquote. The same informant called Chanes a close associate of Frank Castro, a veteran CIA terrorist and drug trafficker who had been the principal organizer of the so-called Carew terrorist network of 1976, responsible for the blowing up of a Cuban civilian airliner. In yet another FBI report, Castro admitted working with Chanes to supply Corvo with food and ammunition, and also to meeting Hull. In one interview, Corvo told the FBI he had trained Moises Nunez, who was, quote, assisting the anti-communist cause in Central America, unquote. Nunez and Chanes were identified by company records as officers of Frigoríficos de Puntarenas, a company alleged by a narcotics informant to have been an investment made with profits from drugs. In a later interview, Corvo readily confessed to his conspiratorial violation of anti-neutrality laws as part of a network involving John Hull, Frank Chanes, and Felipe Vidal. Quoting, Corvo stated that the only crimes he had committed are United States neutrality violations for shipping weapons from South Florida to Central America. The non-lethal equipment and paramilitary supplies were stored at the residence of Frank Chanes in southwest Miami. Stephen Carr and Robert Thompson were also on the cargo plane. Corvo stated John Hull and Felipe Vidal, a.k.a. Morgan, drove Carr and Thompson to the new training camp in Pocosol. Interrupting the narrative here, recall that Stephen Carr was one of the Christic Institute witnesses who died under strained circumstances in December of 1986. His death, by the way, covered in Radio Free America 33. Continuing here with Peter Dale Scott's text. In short, the Kerry Report exhibits corroborate the initial allegations explored by Kerry's personal staff in 1986, linking Hull, Vidal, Corvo, Chanes, Nunez, and Frank Castro to a conspiratorial network involved in both drug trafficking and in gun running. The same allegations were at the core of the Christic Institute suit filed in May of 1986 against the first five of these individuals. So I guess, no, Castro was not actually involved. Frank Castro, that is, was not actually named as a Christic defendant. I didn't think so. Reviewing or repeating that last sentence. The same allegations were at the core of the Christic Institute suit filed in May of 1986 against the first five of these individuals, so I was correct about Castro not being one of the defendants. Therefore, it can be said conservatively that at least some of the charges in the Christic suit claiming an ongoing conspiracy have now been proven. The Justice Department itself, after prodding from Senator Kerry, has reluctantly indicted individuals both for gun running, Rene Corvo, and for drug trafficking and money laundering through a complex of shrimp companies, including Frigoríficos de Puntarenas. By the way, remember, Frigoríficos de Puntarenas is going to crop up later in the broadcast. The FBI documents reprinted in the Kerry report roughly outlined the Corvo or Costa investigation that a Miami FBI agent, Kevin Currier, C-U-R-R-I-E-R, was eager to prosecute in early of 1986, but which was rendered inactive after the Justice Department in Washington became aware of it. What made the Corvo gun-running incident so sensitive was not just the deterrent effect knowledge of it might have had on the willingness of Congress to restore military aid to the Contras, which they did in June of 1986. There was the fact that the smuggling was protected. The arms, including the cannon, had, according to witnesses, been loaded onto the plane in broad daylight, even though the export declarations given to Customs described the shipments as clothing and medical supplies for the refugees of San Salvador. The same documents prove that the plane flew to Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, a military base at which both Contra representatives like Luis Posada and U.S. military personnel were present, where special prior permission to land was required. Let me reread that last sentence because it's difficult with the parenthetical item that is in the middle of it. The same documents prove that the plane flew to Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, a military base at which both Contra representatives like Luis Posada and U.S. military personnel were present, where special prior permission to land was required. Add to this that at least one of the Kerry staff witnesses had seen the weapons stored in the presence of cocaine, and you see the sensitivity of the March 1985 Corvo shipment, a U.S. government-protected guns-for-drugs operation in which those protected included suspected major drug smugglers who were also notorious CIA-trained terrorists. This U.S. government protection appears to have been ongoing. We shall see in the next chapter that the U.S. Contra support operation included, according to the Kerry Report and its documents, some of the largest drug traffickers in Latin America. But even in the Corvo case, we see from the FBI documents that this U.S. government protection was being extended to individuals who had been indicted for previous narcotics offenses, always to have the indictments thrown out. Frank Castro, for example, had been indicted under both Operation TikToks and Operation Grouper, two notorious DEA cases that went nowhere. Operation Grouper had been handled by a corrupt member of Vice President George Bush's Task Force on Drugs, who was himself eventually convicted. The FBI investigation, read together with the Kerry hearings, suggests that the Corvo-Chanez-Hull connection was part of a larger operation on the Southern Front, which also involved John Hull and Jorge Morales, a self-confessed smuggler of arms to the Contras, which were paid for by cocaine. Morales, by the way, was described in his activities were touched on in Radio Free America number 29. We also came back to him later in number 33. Continuing with Scott's text, the operation goes back to the lean year of 1983, when congressional aid to the Contras was limited, first by the Boland Amendment to stopping Nicaraguan arms flows to insurgents in El Salvador. The operation goes back to the lean year of 1983, when congressional aid to the Contras was limited by the first Boland Amendment to stopping Nicaraguan arms flows to insurgents in El Salvador. I misread that. This restriction, of course, made it especially difficult to fund the Southern Front in Costa Rica. In the next chapter, we should look at the larger evidence that there was extensive drug funding for the Contras in this period. But the protection enjoyed by Corvo dates back to at least mid-1983, when both Morales and his pilot, Gary Betzner, began using Fort Lauderdale Executive Airport and Ilopango Airport for the same kind of Contra support arms flights as Corvo, with the difference that, by their own admission, their flights on a later leg shipped drugs. How did all this come about? It appears that John Hull, after meeting Frank Castro at his ranch in Costa Rica, came to Miami with the Morales-trained drug pilot Geraldo Duran in June or July of 1983 and went to the office of the admitted guns for cocaine trafficker Jorge Morales. At this time, Hull's colleague Bill Crone visited a Frank Castro Rene Corvo training camp near Naples, Florida, and also discussed the transfer of a DC-3 that was eventually delivered to the Contra forces of Aden Pastora by Morales. Robert Owen later reported to North that it was, quote, former Bay of Pigs veteran Frank Castro, who was heavily into drugs, who gave Pastora the new DC-3 delivered by Morales. In short, the protection for the two Corvo flights out of Fort Lauderdale may have been just the tip of the protection for the Jorge Morales iceberg. Some of Morales' repeated flights of weapons for drugs were also out of Fort Lauderdale, and his planes would fly either to Ilopango or to John Hull's ranch. Those protected in the Corvo flight out of Fort Lauderdale were not only drug traffickers, they were also notorious terrorists. The FBI investigation into the Corvo gun shipment involved not only Frank Castro, the former organizer of Coru, but many others linked to previous instances of terrorism. The FBI documents confirmed that, as FBI agent Currier suggested to the Iran-Contra committees, Corvo, Francisco Chanez, Frank Castro, Armando Lopez Estrada, and others were at the time of the flight already under investigation for their alleged role in the May 1983 bombing of the Continental National Bank of Miami. The list of Rene Corvo and Frank Castro associates in the FBI documents is a litany of terrorists associated with previous unauthorized terrorist incidents in the United States and Canada, from Omega 7, Luis Crespo, back to the Pragmatistas of the Watergate burglar era, Rafael Perez, alias Torpedo. One, Ramon Sanchez, had even been part of an attempt by Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis in 1963, narrowly averted by the FBI and British police, to sink a Soviet tanker and thus frustrate the entente established between Kennedy and Khrushchev after the Cuban Missile Crisis. In short, when added to other documents from the Iran, Contra, and Christic depositions, there is now a strong evidence that the illegalities of this Rene Corvo, Frank Castro, Felipe Vidal connection were more extensive, more high-level, and more murderous than the FBI documents indicate by themselves. Finally, we should view the protected terrorism of the Frank Castro, Felipe Vidal connection in the 1980s, when George Bush was in charge of the war on drugs and, quote, counter-terrorist activities, unquote, as a prolongation of the protected terrorism of the Frank Castro, Armando Lopez Estrada, Luis Posada Carriles connection in 1976, when George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. Indeed, both are only the most recent anti-terrorist, unquote, manifestations of an ongoing scandal of drug-financed covert operations that indeed dates back for almost three decades. Thus, the scale of both protected trafficking and protected terrorism ensured that, when Senator Kerry and his staff began to look into it, there would be the most strenuous effort to discredit them and their witnesses. So again, there are documents obtained by the Kerry subcommittee from the FBI which tend to confirm many of the key allegations made by the Christic Institute concerning the culpability of Frank Chanez, John Hull, Felipe Vidal, and although not named in their suit, also Frank Castro, in drug smuggling on behalf of the Contras. Remember the name Frigoríficos de Puntareñas, because we're going to come back to that in a little while as well. Now, with regard to the connections of these activities to the SNL-CIA's connection, as yet, we don't have the smoking gun. We've got many of the same people from the same milieu involved in the CIA and SNL link. But again, because of records that have not been disclosed, because of denials by people who may or may not be innocent, as yet the smoking gun isn't there. But again, we've got spent shell casings all over the floor. The smell of cordite is very, very thick in the air. It should not be at all surprising that if the evidentiary tributaries contained in this brilliant series by Pete Bruton and the Houston Post, if they are fully investigated, it seems quite reasonable that it would turn up a great many guns, and a great many smoking guns at that, because certainly the people involved here in the activities documented by the Kerry subcommittee, as badly compromised as it was, and the people involved in the activities, intersecting activities, being pursued by the Christic Institute, well, that's obviously the same milieu that we're seeing in the CIA-SNL connection. Whether it turns out to be exactly the same operation remains to be seen, but again, FFT, GFFR, food for thought, grounds for further research. It's also worth noting, too, that what we have seen in the Iran-Contra scandal, the milieu involved there, have been doing this for a long time. In a Radio Free America series, which will be repeated on these broadcasts in the not-too-distant future, Radio Free America shows 24 through 28. We specifically went into the drug smuggling connections of the National Security Establishment and the background of this same milieu. If the name of Carew a CIA-financed anti-Castro organization that was heavily involved in terrorist activities both in this country and in Central America and in Europe, part of what Henrik Kruger referred to as the Internacional Fascista. If the name sounds strange, we are going to be going into this in archive shows in the not-too-distant future. It's basically why we've gotten this extension to 4 hours, because the programs have become so referential over the, well, for me personally now, almost 11 years on the air, and the stretch of the programs going back that full 11 years, that at this point I think it's imperative to repeat the archive shows more frequently than we have been able to do, because so much of the present really depends on the past. As William Faulkner said, the past is never dead, it isn't even past. It's worth noting, too, that ultimately if these activities were ever to be fully exposed, we're going to go back to, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, as Richard Nixon referred to it in the Watergate scandal. The team involved in the Bay of Pigs has cropped up, first of all, in the investigations into the Kennedy assassination, also into the closely related Watergate scandal. We looked at the same team in the Iran-Contra scandal, and until this group is brought to heel, and it doesn't appear they're likely to under the circumstances, we appear likely to be seeing them for a long time to come. And it also serves to underscore one of the points that I have made repeatedly on this broadcast, which is that in investigating this country's political assassinations, we are not just dealing with those assassinations themselves, which are important, but at this point quite distant in history. But the main thing to be gained from investigating those assassinations is to understand contemporary American political reality, to understand that the institutions of democracy and freedom in this country are badly compromised, and that essentially the rule of law vanished on 11-22-63. Ultimately, if an intelligent and viable study of our political assassinations is undertaken by a sizable percentage of the public and the journalistic community, it will be revealed that exactly the kinds of deadly, the sort of deadly force and the kinds of covert operations that are used in the Third World, places like Latin America, to maintain social control, have in fact been used in the United States for a long time. Political assassination, terrorism, things like this happen in this country as well, and they've been happening for a long time, and they've been happening courtesy of the same crew who we saw in the Iran-Contra scandal, the not-so-secret team, as I have called them. And again, it's, I think, a very well-taken point by Peter Dale Scott here that the history of these individuals, the activities they have been involved in for so long, really mandates that these activities be covered up. Those activities appear to be headed for more cover-up, in particular as regards the possibility of CIA connections to the SNL failures, and in turn, a relationship between the CIA-SNL connection and some of the activities set forth by the Kerry Subcommittee and the Christic Institute, some of those activities documented or discussed in the section of the Scott manuscript that I just read. Now, on February 21st of 1990, the Post carried an article about the response, at least the response at that time, by the National Security Establishment, and specifically the CIA, to some of its allegations. I'm not going to read you the whole story, just part of it. This, again, Houston Post, and again, Pete Bruton, and again, this article researched for us by the very dedicated listener, I guess you could call him our SNL Lone Ranger. And he is basically the person who has provided all of these articles to us, and he got us this one as well. Houston Post, February 21st, 1990. Its headline, CIA declines to testify before panel. Subheaded, it says, SNL response is not appropriate, quote unquote. And again, I think Peter Dale Scott said, let me read that last couple of sentences of Peter Dale Scott's, because I think it really does go to the very hub of why we're unlikely to see the SNL-CIA link explored as fully as it would appear to, as the situation would appear to warrant. Finally, we should view the protected terrorism of the Frank Castro-Felipe Vidal connection in the 1980s, when George Bush was in charge of the war on drugs and counter-terrorist activities, as a prolongation of the protected terrorism of the Frank Castro-Armando Lopez Estrada Luis Posada Carriles connection in 1976, when George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. Indeed, both are only the most recent anti-terrorist manifestations of an ongoing scandal of drug-financed covert operations that indeed dates back for almost three decades. Thus, the scale of both protected trafficking and protected terrorism ensured that, when Senator Kerry and his staff began to look into it, there would be the most strenuous efforts to discredit them and their witnesses. I think we can say the same about the upcoming investigation into SNL. Houston Post 22190, right, we see the following. In a move that surprised a congressional subcommittee, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency has declined an invitation to appear before the panel to respond to stories in the Houston Post about possible links between the CIA and organized crime in the nation's savings and loan crisis. In a February 14th letter to U.S. Representative Frank Annunzio, Democrat of Illinois, chairman of the House Subcommittee on Financial Institutions, the CIA said it is not appropriate, quote-unquote, for CIA Director William Webster or other agency officials to appear before the subcommittee to discuss the Post stories. Quote, as a matter of principle, we do not believe it appropriate to dignify with formal congressional testimony scurrilous and unsubstantiated allegations such as those made by the Houston Post, the letter said. The letter accused the Post of basing its stories on a source who has been indicted on a charge of making false statements about being employed by the CIA and of misrepresenting the statements of a federal prosecutor in Houston who was investigating SNL fraud. Houston Post editor-in-chief David Bergen said the CIA's letter distorts the newspaper's report on possible links between the agency and organized crime in the failure of federally insured financial institutions. Quote, the Post stands by its stories, Bergen said. Quote, it isn't the Post making these charges, it's any number of sources, some of whom have come forward at what they believe to be great personal risk, unquote. Well, the allegation to the person who had made false statements about being employed by the CIA, that is the Richard Brennecke referred to in the first article. Those statements were not false statements. They were labeled as false by the CIA and also by journalistic sources who did not, shall we say, pursue the story as thoroughly as they might have. In a miscellaneous archive show called, entitled George Bush's Political Resume, some of the connections between Richard Brennecke and the CIA, and in turn, between Richard Brennecke, the CIA, Heinrich Rupp, George Bush, and the October surprise allegations that basically at this point have been substantiated by a number of sources and indicate a deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini government to withhold the U.S. hostages and thereby ensure Jimmy Carter's election defeat in 1980. Richard Brennecke is the person who basically helped bring out that information in a deposition for the trial of the aforementioned Heinrich Rupp. That's the individual described here as having falsely described employment by the CIA. That was not a false description at all, but again, I refer people to the miscellaneous archive show, George Bush's Political Resume, in which some exploration both of Richard Brennecke's charges and some of the alleged rebuttal of those charges were discussed. Warren Hinkle's done some excellent work on that in the San Francisco Examiner. But it's worth noting here, too, that if some of these connections unravel as far as they might, we might wind up back with the October surprise, the apparent deal between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini government. So the implications here are staggering indeed. Even so, just the information being developed that would link some of the SNL failures to CIA drug trafficking on behalf of the Contras, if in fact that's what caused it, and certainly the milieu implicated in this activity was the same milieu that has been documented, as indicated in the Scott manuscript, to have been involved in Contra-related drug smuggling. Whether that actually hooks up with the CIA-SNL link remains to be seen. Certainly, I think the potential seriousness of the situation will of necessity mandate a huge, huge cover-up by the National Security Establishment. The news media are already doing their part, except for the Houston Post and a few other voices. They are ignoring this very, very important scandal. I think we can assume that in the future that benign neglect, I guess you could say, will be a pattern that we are going to be seeing all too frequently. It's also a good reason why people might do what they can to generate publicity about this. In any event, we're going to take another musical break. Then I'm going to come back with some more articles concerning, well, not directly, at least at first, the SNL scandal, but we're going to talk about related activities, related Contra support drug activities, and some of the connections to General Noriega. And then we're going to come back and ask the musical question about whether or not perhaps the drug tug Lenvest case is part of the same operation that helped to deep six some of the SNLs. Food for thought, grounds for further research. Musical break, then more information here on One Step Beyond. Good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. One of the aspects, as I said, of the SNL-CIA link that I think is most explosive is the, as yet, at least by the Houston Post or anybody else, unexplored connection between the failure of the Silverado Savings and Loan, one of whose directors was Neil Bush, George Bush's son, and the CIA. That connection has yet to be explored by the Houston Post. The only indication is from that very first article in the list of the SNL failures that have been linked to CIA organized crime, there is the Silverado Savings and Loan. Now, Neil Bush is a director of the Silverado Savings and Loan, has been linked to approving some of the loans that brought down Silverado. Whether or not connections between the Silverado Savings and Loan and the CIA are ever brought out, there are some worthwhile questions to be asked in that connection. Now, during the rest of the broadcast, we're going to take a look at other aspects of the Contra-related drug smuggling activity and basically indicate connections between the SNL-CIA link and some of these some of the cases that we are exploring. I suspect that many of these are, in fact, part of the same operation. There are indications that that may be the case. Upon further exploration, these may very well turn out to be different tentacles of the same octopus. I'm going to review a very important tentacle, one which is not getting the national media attention it deserves, just like so many of them. Research credit on this also goes to a listener. This comes from a publication called Westward, which is described as Denver's News and Arts Weekly. It's a publication which I assume is very much like the Metro, the San Jose Metro, in scope and function. And the cover story on the Westward issue of July 13th through July 19th of 1988 is called George Bush's Drug Problem. It's subheaded, How a Convicted Colorado Drug Dealer Won Friends and Influenced People in Very High Places. The author is by Brian, the author is Brian Abbas, A-B-A-S. Now, this particular case involves the Sunflow case, and it's a long article. We haven't got time to read more than a few sections of it. I'm going to outline the Sunflow case briefly. We've gone into this in the past. Now, in a nutshell, Sunflow was a company that was started allegedly to market dehydrators for the third world. These basically were machines that would allegedly dehydrate produce so that it could then be gotten to market without deteriorating. This supposedly would greatly enhance the agricultural production and resulting nutrition of third world nations, alleviating much of the hunger in some of these countries, basically to help alleviate starvation in the third world. That was the stated goal. In fact, the main person involved with the Sunflow company, the individual who basically ran Sunflow, a fellow named Marcello Cabus, or Cabus, C-A-B-U-S, appears to have used the company as a front for drug smuggling activities, and there are some indications that those drug smuggling activities, once again, may be involved with the intelligence community and or the Contra supply effort. And again, some of the same names that we've seen brought up in the Christic Institute suit have been raised in connection with aspects of Sunflow. Now, the main names in Sunflow are this, and again, that's a company to market, allegedly put together to market these dehydrators in the third world, thereby allegedly alleviating third world starvation to a certain extent. In fact, the company appears to have been used as a drug smuggling front. Marcello Cabus is the person who ran Sunflow. He's the main man here, C-A-B-U-S. Also, a very important individual, a black Republican from Washington, D.C., named Arthur Fletcher. He's a person we're going to talk about later on in the broadcast as well. Fletcher accompanied George Bush, then vice president, on a trip to Africa in 1982. It was on this trip that Arthur Fletcher helped to promote Sunflow. Another name brought up in connection with Sunflow is Neil Bush. George Bush's name obviously crops up in connection with it, since it was on a George Bush diplomatic mission to Africa that Arthur Fletcher basically promoted Sunflow in the first place. Also, the name of Adolf Coors III, part of the very influential and conservative Coors family of California, of Colorado, the beer magnates, I guess you could say. Adolf Coors III has also been connected with Sunflow's operations. So the main names here that we want to be looking at are George and Neil Bush, Arthur Fletcher, the Coors family, specifically Adolf Coors III, and Marcello Cabus, or Cabus. I've never heard it spoken aloud. And again, bear in mind that these operations, these drug smuggling operations, by, or allegations of drug smuggling by Sunflow, have in turn been connected by a number of people to some of the same operations that we've been talking about in connection with the Contra Support effort, and specifically drug smuggling on behalf of Contra Support. Now, the question that I'm asking here is whether or not we're going to see connections, or whether we will see connections between the Sunflow case and the Silverado Savings and Loan. Both take place in Colorado. Neil Bush's name has cropped up in connection with both. And with the possibilities of Contra-related drug smuggling here in the Sunflow case, I think this is a worthwhile question to ask. One which, again, I think if it could be answered in the affirmative, we're not likely to see the answer cropping up in the major American news media. So far, only the Westword publication that I am aware of, anyway, has covered the Sunflow case. But it's a very important case, potentially explosive, and we're going to go into it right now. Again, from Westword, July 13th through July 19th of 1988. And actually, Abbas on the inside calls this article Dealer's Choice. A Colorado invention was supposed to stop world hunger, but instead it left investors high and dry. A growing problem these days, both with Drug Tug, LendVest, CIA and SNL connections, and apparently also in the Sunflow case as well. Now, skipping well into Brian Abbas's article here, we come on the first of the names that are of significance for us, and that's the name of a black Republican from Washington, D.C., Arthur Fletcher. Brian Abbas writes as follows in the Westword publication, and he writes of Fletcher, Sunflow soon made its first important political connection. Arthur Fletcher, a Washington, D.C.-based Republican business consultant who'd been an assistant secretary of labor in the Nixon administration. Fletcher says he was introduced to Cabus and Sunflow by Jasper Jones, a D.C. accountant and friend. Skipping down in the article, Fletcher's most valuable contribution was to promote Sunflow while on a seven-country tour of Africa with Bush in November of 1982. The vice president had invited three prominent black Americans along on the trip, a doctor, an educator, and a businessman. As a prominent and rare black Republican, Fletcher was a logical person to take along to represent the business side. Fletcher says he's known Bush since the early 70s when he was a minority affairs consultant to the Republican National Committee and Bush was the committee's director. Fletcher readily accepted Bush's invitation to join the tour. Bush had hoped to encourage some frank and informative exchange between the black leaders on his trip and the ministers of the African countries they were visiting, says Tad Garrett, then Bush's assistant for domestic affairs and Fletcher's contact. The private sector members of Bush's entourage were given a great deal of freedom in what they said to the ministers they met. Quote, we never had any knowledge about the promotion of one particular company, Garrett says. Fletcher, though, says he was informed Garrett would... Fletcher, though, says he informed Garrett he would be promoting Sunflow and told him about the dehydrator and what it could do to alleviate hunger. Fletcher didn't bother to tell Garrett the firm was run by a convicted drug dealer. He was confident Garrett trusted him. Quote, use your best judgment on how you can be most effective on the trip, he quotes Garrett as saying. So it was that during Bush's 1982 tour of Africa, the vice president unwittingly helped promote a firm run by a convicted drug dealer who was acting as though he was still dealing drugs and was being watched by Colorado narcotics agents convinced he was back in the drug business. So again, George Bush, on a seven-country diplomatic tour of Africa while vice president in 1982, takes along Arthur Fletcher. Arthur Fletcher helps to promote Sunflow. Bear in mind, though, that everybody here is always innocent. In all of these cases, of course, no one admits to any wrongdoing. It should also be underscored that in these cases so far, no legal findings have been obtained. There is no hard evidence linking Arthur Fletcher to any sort of illegal activities. He, of course, proclaims his innocence. However, as has become apparent in so many of these cases, and as is the case with Sunflow, a lot of the information that might have come out is either being deliberately suppressed or is not being pursued because a lot of the people involved in allegedly investigating these situations have apparent connections to the people involved in them. So the lack of hard evidence of wrongdoing in so many of these cases does not in any way mean that it isn't there. There was an interesting statement recently made at a talk that Father Bill Davis of the Christic Institute gave in Palo Alto. He pointed out that Zsa Gabor has done more jail time for slapping a cop in L.A. than all of the defendants in the Iran-Contra scandal so far put together. She did, but like 4 days, that's more than all of them put together have done in jail. In any event, skipping down from Arthur Fletcher, and Fletcher's a very important name to remember. We'll be coming back to Arthur Fletcher. Brian Abbas writes as follows. In June of 1983, Bush's role as Reagan's point man in the war against drugs had expanded. The vice president was named to coordinate an intensified drug interdiction effort across the southern border of the U.S. In Colorado, the race was on between Cabus and the Narcs. Agents secured a judge's authorization to install wiretaps on telephones in Marcello's office. William Marcello was a Cabus associate in Sunflow. Agents secured a judge's authorization to install wiretaps on telephones in Marcello's office, Tufts' home near Boulder, and three other residences. The telephones in the Sunflow office weren't tapped, however, nor was the phone in Cabus' Western Slope farmhouse. The taps provided evidence of drug dealing. Evidence were convinced they had prosecutable cases against several people, but they couldn't get any local district attorney to file charges. One of the agents, a Denver detective, says his superiors were reluctant to allow him to spend more time on a case centered in Boulder. The other agent was with the Arvada Police Department, but few of the alleged crimes had occurred in Jefferson County. Even Boulder County District Attorney Alex Hunter wouldn't take the case. He refused to comment to Westward, but according to one of the agents, Hunter was reluctant because the evidence hadn't been collected by Boulder officials and because no drugs had been seized. The agents were grounded until October when David Thomas, an assistant Denver District Attorney and now Colorado's Director of Public Safety, joined a newly created federal drug task force operating under the direction of U.S. Attorney Robert Miller, the chief federal prosecutor in Colorado and a Reagan appointee. Thomas knew the Denver detective who'd helped lead the investigation into Cabus and Friends. Using the evidence collected by state agents, he agreed to seek federal drug charges from a grand jury. Thomas's cooperation was a major breakthrough, but there were still obstacles. Defense lawyers challenged Thomas's decision to use evidence from wiretaps authorized by a state judge in federal court, citing a Colorado law that appeared to restrict the use of such evidence to state courts. Another problem was that John O'Neill, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration chief in Denver, refused to assist in the probe. By the time Thomas joined up, the DEA had successfully cracked other major Colorado-based drug rings. Those investigations were taking up most of the agency's resources and were also resulting in large caches of drugs that could be paraded before television cameras. Thomas says O'Neill told him he had a weak case with serious legal problems, including the possibility the wiretap evidence would be rejected. Although Thomas says he didn't question O'Neill's motives, the investigation suffered. Quote, "I never felt I had all the resources I needed to fully investigate this case," Thomas says. "I felt a little hampered because I didn't have that expertise the DEA is on my side," unquote. Thomas took his case to the grand jury anyway, but by the time he obtained grand jury indictments in late 1984, the investigation lacked staff, funds, and support. Even if Thomas could have persuaded those indicted to provide testimony against higher-ups, he lacked the resources to pursue leads. The best he could hope for was a series of convictions or guilty pleas for the few people on which they had goods. Now, skipping down still further, and again, there's going to be yet more evidence later on that these investigations were not pursued as vigorously as they might have, and that one of the reasons is that some of the foxes basically were in charge of the hen house. Now, here's where the name of Coors comes in, specifically, actually not Adolph Coors, the third, Adolph Coors the fourth is the individual here. He's the son of Adolph the third. Sometimes it's hard to keep my Adolphs straight on this particular program. Of the Coors connection now to the Sunflow operation, and bear in mind it's Adolph Coors the fourth, the son of Adolph the third. Excuse me. In the summer of 1984, Cabus connected with one of Colorado's most powerful families, the Coors family. In the 80s, the Coors family expanded its influence outside the state. William and Joseph Coors, great-grandsons of the brewery's founder, were principals in the national conservative political movement that capped a string of successes by electing Reagan and Bush in 1980. They also helped fund such conservative think tanks as the Heritage Foundation and fill Reagan's cabinet with conservative Coloradans. EPA Director Ann Gorsuch Burford, Bureau of Land Management Director Robert Burford, and Interior Secretary James Watt were all Coors recommendations. During Reagan's second term, Joseph Coors donated $65,000 to one of the president's favorite causes, the rebels trying to overthrow the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Adolph Coors IV is the son of the late Adolph III, the third William and Joseph Coors' brother, who was kidnapped and killed in 1960. Young Adolph was never involved in politics or the family brewery as his uncles brewery as his uncles and their sons. In 1979, he left the brewery to devote all his time to a Christian ministry he'd founded.